Hi, I'm Jay Dansinghani, founder and editor of All Over Cricket and host of the All Over Cricket podcast. For episode 3, I'm joined by Karunya Keshav, who along with the late Siddhanta Patnaik, co-authored a book called The Fire Burns Blue, A History of Women's Cricket in India. She also co-authored the Equal Hue Report, along with former India cricketer Snehal Pradhan. The Equal Hue Project aims to chart the way forward for women's cricket in India and was compiled using, among other things, the views of hundreds of female cricketers in the country. You can follow her on Twitter at Cooks, that's K-U-K-S. Karunya and I talk about the women's IPL, or lack thereof, pathways to the national team for age group and domestic players, as well as the challenges faced by women's cricketers in India. So Karunya, I'm sure the viewers will know this about the All Over Cricket podcast. We do not beat around the bush at all. So let's get straight into it. And, you know, just tell me a little bit about the BCCI's stance towards women's cricket. And I hope this question doesn't sound rhetorical, but why we don't have a fully fledged women's IPL yet?
The story of BCCI and women's cricket in India is a pretty long and slightly convoluted one. I think, as is the case with women's cricket in so many countries, a lot of things changed in the mid-2000s, and that was the case in India as well. So around 2005, 2006 was when the BCCI came in and took over the running of women's cricket. So for some time, things went on really well. So the thing about the BCCI is, even though there's so much criticism against them, and a lot of them rightly so, the infrastructure for cricket in India is massive, and the passion for cricket in India is massive. So you already have an answer to two pretty significant challenges that a lot of other countries have to deal with. So there is no question about the passion for women's cricket, or passion for any cricket in India, and facilities, infrastructure, especially run by the BCCI, are also really strong, and it's getting stronger as well. So on that side, there are probably no complaints. In terms of access to these facilities since 2010, there's been no real issue. So you have someone like a Mithali Raj being able to use the same facilities as a lot of the male cricketers. And this isn't a problem. There's no real space where, you know, you say, okay, the women can't come and train at the NCA just because the men are doing it. No, you have Julan Goswami training at the NCA just like Bhuvneshwar Kumar or, you know, someone else like that. So that isn't the problem. The issue is intent and administration. So the BCCI does not have a separate wing for women's cricket. And because with the men's game in India, you don't really need the BCCI to do too much work to get, you know, for the men's game to bring in money. There's no real need to do any marketing when it comes to the men's game at all. But these are things that are required in the women's game, and the BCCI just doesn't have that sort of structure to enable it. If there is someone in charge of women's cricket, so, you know, just this one point person, and this is a system that has worked in so many other places. We've seen it work in England, we've seen it work in Australia. If there is a dedicated group of people who will prioritize women's cricket, because women's cricket does have its own requirements and it does have its own chances of success, which is very different from the men's game. And essentially, the fact that there is no administrative structure in place to enable this does hold things back. The BCCI, a lot of the time with women's cricket, ends up doing a lot of firefighting, maybe. That's what the BCCI has set up to do. Things just run. So there's not too many things for which you need to have a five-year vision or a 10-year vision with the men's team. But with the women's team, you do need to do that. You do need to build these pathways that more girls can come in. And that sort of long-term vision, because of how political things have been in the BCCI, because of these various issues that they've had with the courts, that just hasn't happened. Apart from that, I also spoke about intent. And I think that is something that can be changed. So unfortunately, the women's team seems like an afterthought. So the Indian women's team has consistently performed possibly beyond expectations in the last few World Cups. So 2017, they made it to the final, was so close to winning. At 2018 T20 World Cup, they made it to the semi-finals, defeated Australia. We had this amazing Harmanpreet Kaur century again. 2020 again, they were part of history. So it seems like they've been at a tipping point for the past 3-4 years. They've just not got that final push. that can help them take the next step. And this is where the BCCI needs to come in and sort of invest in them, create structures in place that enables this team that is already so good, that is already so talented, to maximize their potential.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely hear what you're saying. And see, after 2017, at least I feel like the momentum was there to really reform things and kick things up a gear in women's cricket. And I mean, just to take an example outside of India, after the West Indies won the World T20 in 2016, I'm talking about the women, of course, not the men. I think it was Courtney Walsh who said, you know, that was the time for the WICB to really start taking women's cricket really, really seriously. Strangely enough, it's almost as if the West Indies have gone downhill since 2016. It's almost as if, I wouldn't say they've gotten worse, but things have stagnated with the West Indies. And something as simple as just having a network of scouts, like you feel like this is such an obvious thing to do, but they don't seem to really have that system in place. I know Skerrett has come up with a 10-point plan that also addresses women's cricket. And I think, you know, you look at India and it's very similar in that sense. After 2017, the momentum was there. After 2020, March 2020, what was it, 86,000 people at the final. I know COVID got in the way, but you had an announcement about the Women's T20 Challenge and clarity about it coming only after the men's IPL had begun. This just serves as a good segue to my next question about the women's IPL. I know it's not the be-all and end-all of fixing women's cricket in India, but how close do you think we are to a women's IPL? That's the first question. And secondly, what else is needed in addition to a women's IPL?
You mentioned that the women's IPL is not the be-all and end-all of issues in India. That's definitely true. But it is such a massive part because it can solve so many little issues that there are in the structure right now. Let me just take a little bit of time to explain why a women's IPL is important. Firstly, the financial security that it can provide to so many players. So right now, because there are so few matches happening in the domestic system, there are not enough opportunities for the girls, for the women to earn that money to sustain themselves in a career in cricket. And something like the IPL, women's IPL, we've seen what it can do for the men. It can completely revolutionize and make it maybe like a semi-professional structure in India. Second big advantage, it would obviously helping this whole depth argument that, you know, always comes up when we talk about the women's IPL. Every time we say, okay, we should have a women's IPL, the argument is that there's just not enough depth in Indian women's cricket. And the ironic thing is the IPL is precisely what you need to address this issue. So we've seen with the WBBL also how year on year, the six hitting, the chasing, all of that, it's just grown so exponentially. And then the difference between, say, something like the sixes hit by a domestic player and by an international player in the WBBL, that gap is coming down as well. So that's exactly what you need the IPL for. We saw in the 2020 World Cup how, I mean, there's this massive difference between Australia in the final and India in the final. And it seems almost obvious that the first thing you think of, you know, to give an explanation for that is that the Australians were just so much more used to that sort of pressure, that sort of expectation. I think we've been close to a women's IPL for a while now, and it's just not happened. So you have to ask why. In terms of talent, in terms of depth, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of support for the tournament, all of that is in place for the women's IPL. We just right now need basically team names and team jerseys to just, you know, and sort of some investment from the BC side to say, okay, we're going to commit to this for the next few years. There are various ways of doing it. What is required right now is honestly just that commitment. That was precisely how the IPL started in 2008. It was, in a way, a slightly mad dream. India had, you know, just won the T20 World Cup. You had a rebel T20 tournament happening, and you had everyone talking about T20. And even though a lot of the same arguments that we're still hearing for the women's IPL, all of them was applicable in 2008 for the men as well, saying, oh, you know, do we have the depth? Do we have the resources? Are people going to watch this? All of that just sorted itself out because BCCI basically just made it happen. And that is the strength of the BCCI. That has been the strength of the BCCI for years. If just given the might that they have, they can just make things happen if they want to. So all these excuses that we have about, even COVID, seems like just an excuse because of the various things that the BCCI have made happen for the men. So yeah, primary thing to sort out right now is essentially just the intent, the rules, the teams, all of that will fall into place the minute you say we're just going to go ahead and do it. And I think there are loads of people ready, you know, waiting to invest in this and saying, you know, we'll back this, we'll run this. Even if the BCCI don't want to do it, we can do it. And that interest is there. It's just for these two different viewpoints to sort of converge right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I certainly see where you're coming from. Like I said before, like I really feel like there is momentum. There's been momentum building for so many years. I guess my next question is, if I'm a young player, let's say I'm a young player in Andhra, I'm 16 years old, but I'm not exactly a Shefali Varma yet. You know, I'm not hitting every single bowler who comes across me out of the park. But at the same time, if I was that same 16-year-old player in Australia, maybe that there would be a more well-defined pathway. So let's say I am a young player in Andhra. I'm 16 years old. I'm 15 years old. Whether or not it's my dream to play for the national team, how do you get that player through the system? How do you get that player playing state cricket? How do you get that player playing international cricket for India?
So if you're from Andhra, you're probably lucky because Andhra does have a really strong system in place for women's cricket. They're one of the few states that actually has an academy for girls where they choose a bunch of girls from different parts, from different districts. They give them a stipend and support their education as well. And they really have a pipeline in place. That is not the case in many other states. There's some states in India that do have academies and do have sort of, I guess the big issue is monetary support. So they do have some sort of educational and financial support in place for girls that they've identified are talented enough and can move through the system. And as I said, that's not the case everywhere in India. In most places, it would mean that you probably watched your brother's play, you've watched your, you know, people in your family play, they've probably given you a chance to sort of bowl a bit at them or, you know, field a bit, maybe not bat as much. And then, you know, one day when you're going with them to their academy where they're practicing, someone spots you and says, you know, why, you know, there's actually a girls team that does this for like one day a week somewhere in one corner of the ground, why don't you come by? And that system is actually relatively strong. So you do have a lot of players who are involved in the women's cricket system who keep an eye out for talent. And the minute they find something, you know, they do all they can to support this girl through her journey. So we have so many people in the present team who've actually come up just like this because someone has spotted them playing at a ground somewhere and pushed them through. So Jemima is the same case. Shefali is pretty much the same case as well, right? Where you had someone who's just seen them identify this talent and said, you know, let's do all we can to push this girl through. One issue is that you won't have a chance to play that many school tournaments. School cricket, especially for girls, is really minimal. You will probably have to, you know, you'll end up playing a few games for your academy if you can afford it. You will probably join some camps or trials that the states call for. And just simply because of the numbers right now, if you're really good in a couple of years, you can break into the state team. The state structure is pretty interesting because in terms of just numbers, there are a lot of matches that happen, but they're not enough. I think it's still, I'm sorry, I forget the number, but it's still somewhere between 7 and 10 matches that a lot of the people end up playing in a year, which is really not sufficient if you're trying to make a career. Again, average. Okay, obviously, if you're a junior cricketer, if you're a teen, you get to play under 19, you get to play under 23. All that is in place. But if you are, say, 27 and you're not playing all these formats and you're not playing for one of the top teams and you get knocked out early, you're probably not going to play that many matches. A big step forward, if you want to play for your country, would be in getting a job and joining the railways, because the railways right now is the biggest source of employment for female cricketers in India. And they also have a really strong team and they have a really strong structure and lots of rivalry between the various railway zones. So you have the best players in the country wanting to represent the railways. And again, because of the competition that they have within the railways itself, they do end up having to lift their game. And that we've seen with a lot of cricketers. So everyone from Mithali Raj, Poonam Rao, Ekta Bish, Rajeshwari Gaikwad, all of them are from the railways structure. And even a lot of the players who play for the state teams do have jobs with the railways as well. So they balance work and play. So it isn't a terrible pathway, but it's just not enough, because the comparison especially is in the teen years, where boys do get to play a lot of school cricket. They have a lot of under 14, under 12, under 9 cricket. So a 16-year-old boy would have played so much more competitive cricket than a 16-year-old girl. And that is where the difference lies, and that is where a lot of the inequalities in the system sort of really find root there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched on this a minute ago. And I think the best illustration for this, and I mean this in a literal sense, is an illustration on the Equal Hue website, where it basically paints a picture that, like you said, there's less job security, less earnings and avenues to generate income for a woman's cricketer and athlete. And there are fewer tournaments as well. So it's harder to develop those same sort of skills that you would see from, let's say, a teenager in Australia. And that's really where we should be aiming. But the cost of playing cricket, the cost of bats, pads, helmets, you know, what have you, that is exactly the same as men's cricketers. And sometimes it's even more, because you don't have the luxury of sponsorship if you're a 16-year-old aspirant for the state team, for example. So can you just talk us through that a little bit?
The cost is one of the biggest barriers to girls taking part in cricket in India. You do have the social aspect of it, and you do have some infrastructural barriers as well. And by infrastructure, I mean things like toilets, you know, girls' toilet, or having changing rooms. You know, in these grounds where you see people playing cricket, you're not going to have a girls' changing room always. But yeah, definitely the financial aspect is a massive barrier. As you said, the cost of playing cricket is the same. Cricket is an expensive sport, especially once you start taking it seriously. If you're just playing it with tennis balls and a plastic bat, sure, that's more accessible to everybody. But the minute you want to take it seriously, the minute you start playing, even at a slightly competitive level, even, you know, between academies, you need the pads, you need the bats, you need the whole kit. And that is a massive investment. You need a coach, and you need to be paying your coach. So all of that is a massive investment, and there's not enough scholarship or financial support existing. As I said, there are some academies that do offer this, but for the most part, we can say it's not available. And you mentioned the Equal Hue project, which is basically a collaborative effort where we spoke to a bunch of female cricketers and asked them and tried to identify what the state of cricket in India was at that point. Everything from, you know, their diet to what matches they like playing, what format, all of that. So and it aims to sort of identify the challenges that exist and seeing how we can bring together a lot of stakeholders to address these issues. And there are attempts being made to sort of make cricket more accessible, especially on the financial side, but it is difficult. So what happens right now is that a lot of the girls end up sharing equipment. A lot of the academies have like a communal kit that people sort of share. I don't think this is particularly, you know, it's just for the girls. I think there are a lot of boys also that go through this. But I mean, I think it gets a little complicated for the girls because of the social angle. The fact that traditionally in India, people don't invest as much into the girls, into their education, into their food, as they would to the boys. So, this has been an issue for years, and something like the pandemic has only made it worse. The fact that, you know, on various indices, especially like, you know, nutrition, education, you still find girls losing out because families choose to prioritize the boys' needs over the girls. And something like cricket is probably way down the ladder of essential needs for most families, and girls do lose out on it.
I'm glad you touched on that, actually. And it just kind of made me, as an Indian man, I guess it kind of made me reflect on my, for lack of a better word, my privilege, I guess. Like, everybody in my family is vegetarian. But when I was growing up, it was always like, okay, you know what? Jay's allowed to eat chicken. Jay's allowed to eat egg because, you know, he's got to be strong. He's a man and all that stuff. And when you were speaking about that, it just brought it back to me. Now, I'm not saying everybody should just go non-veg, but certainly, you know, there are a lot of challenges that young girls and even women have to deal with that we don't really, as men or as boys, we don't have to think twice about. Something small, just the issue of traveling to games. Men and boys, we don't have to think about being safe or unsafe on a bus, about being subject to Eve teasing or even harassment. It just blew my mind. It was a big wake-up call. Can you talk to us more about just that social angle and how much of a barrier that is?
It's a massive barrier. And it's one of the reasons you need a women's wing. You need more women in charge to actually understand these various pain points on a girl's journey to being a sports person. There was an interesting story told to Siddhanta Patnaik, who's my co-author on the book, and me, by this coach in Bombay, where he said that he asks his girls to wear their cricket outfit before they come to the field or below their regular clothes, so they don't require the changing room, and that sort of barrier is erased. And it's things like that. A lot of the girls that we've spoken to mention how traveling to their ground has been one of the most challenging aspects of this whole, of the whole cricketing journeys, essentially. Simply because, you know, buses and trains are just, everyone seems story of being harassed, you know, on a bus, on a train. And the issue also is that there's not enough structures in place to address that. So say, for example, a girl does get harassed in a bus, they hesitate to tell their parents because, A, they just don't want to, you know, worry their family because, you know, they're going to say, oh, then maybe don't go. Don't, you know, it's not safe for you to go play cricket, so don't go. So there is that hesitancy to say, and there are no structures in place on the coaching side of things as well in the academies to address these sort of issues. And I think that's something where the state associations and the BCCI can come in, and having these regular conversations about safety, just to increase the awareness that there are people that you can go to and talk to, that, you know, you don't have to deal with this alone. Even if it's just someone misbehaving on a bus, this is exactly what you can do. And this is, you know, it's not a reflection on you. It's not a reflection of what you as a girl can or can't do, because these are things that these girls end up holding on to even when they play cricket. You know, they're afraid that, as I said, they're afraid of telling their parents or their families, because someone's going to come back and say, well, this is dangerous. This is why we say cricket is not, you know, why, this is why we say sports isn't for girls. And a lot of this comes from good intentions. So it's, you know, it's not always parents saying, no, you shouldn't play sport. They're genuinely worried about how their child is going to have to, you know, be able to deal with the situation. Traveling to competitions is another place where we've heard anecdotally that parents really hesitate to let their children continue with the sport. You know, who is going to take care of their child when they're in another city? Are there systems in place? As of now, very often the answer is no. So it's a little, you know, even in places where there are changed attitudes, there are very valid security concerns. There are very valid concerns for the welfare of a girl. And so I don't want to just dismiss it as, you know, just these old prejudices. Of course, there are plenty of those things like, oh, you know, you'll get too dark by playing cricket, or, you're going to find it difficult to get married, or, okay, now you're getting married, enough now, stop playing cricket, or, you know, finish college now, get a job, don't play cricket. So, I mean, all those biases are there and they're all very existent. But at the same time, there are also lots of very valid social concerns. And both of these need to be tackled separately.
I think you spoke about this in a podcast with Jared Kimber as well. You know, the whole pressure around getting married and just a woman's role, not just in Indian society, but in a lot of Asian cultures. That expectation that, you know, you have to get married by a certain age, whether it's 20, 21, 23, whatever. And if you're playing, you're gonna get dark, and I guess, for lack of a better word, your stocks go down as a viable partner for marriage and a viable candidate for marriage. And, you know, just talk to us about a big word in Indian culture, the M word.
This is a pretty complicated topic, primarily because we don't have the data, right? So everything we know about this is anecdotal. A lot of people in the system would say that anecdotally, it seems that one of the points where we lose women, the one point where they end up dropping out more, is at this age where they get married. So again, anecdotally, my theory is that you have a lot of really young girls playing cricket, and you have a lot of people above 30 playing. That 24 to 28, 29, there seem to be fewer cricketers. The thing is, there is no data anywhere to actually say this is why girls are dropping out of cricket in India. And I think that is really important to find out before we actually say anything comprehensively. But definitely, it does seem that once girls get this, you know, close to the so-called marriageable age, they do drop out of cricket. A related reason is also because that's at the same age where you want something that is more stable. You want some income coming in, and cricket is not giving you that. So it's, you know, the same thing we spoke about earlier. So it's very often one or both of these things working together. We have very few big name cases of women playing at the elite level after marriage. That may change now that there is more money in the game. At the domestic level, we have seen the occasional stories, and they're lovely stories of women just trying to balance everything and trying to do everything. And I think that's a story that so many of us completely relate with. But at the same time, there is a very real acknowledgement and understanding of the various challenges, which is probably the challenges faced by any woman trying to work and have a family. So it does require a massive support system. It requires understanding partners, understanding in-laws, supportive parents. It requires the option of healthcare. And all of this, again, you know, you spoke about privilege earlier. The women who do end up doing this, it's because they are in a certain privileged position. Definitely money, but also in terms of having the supportive system in place. Having, you know, those parents who say, you know, you go ahead and do anything, I'll take on the comments and the barbs that come from the community, I'll handle it. And we do have some lovely cases of that happening. We do have cases of women who have chosen to get married and it's not worked out for the same reasons that, you know, spoke of. It's not easy trying to pursue a career in sport when you also have certain responsibilities. Maybe if there were these systems in place, it would be a different matter. But especially because they aren't, it does make it difficult. And there are lots of marriages that have broken. Again, most of this happens in the second rung of cricket. I haven't seen too many in the, you know, among elite players. Because again, the ones who continue playing for really long just happen to be unmarried. The others are just really young. I mean, the Indian team at the 2020 World Cup had an average age of what, 21, 23, what was it? And so these aren't questions that have really come up yet at the very elite level. But definitely in the lower levels, you know, where you continue playing cricket, not only because you think you're going to make it to the highest level, of course that is there, but also because you think, you know, you just enjoy the game. It's just part of you. It's just what you want. So it is a massive challenge to balance all of these various drivers. Some people have been able to do it successfully. And more stories need to be told about them, because that's exactly the kind of inspiration you need. And it's exactly what you should be telling other people. But I don't think that changes the fact that there are a lot of cases where, you know, they aren't success stories. As the cricket fraternity, you sort of have to ask, well, what can we do to help? And also, as you know, as a society, understand that these are very real, you know, very real issues holding women back.
Just curious. Do you actually have, I know this is actually, I feel like this has been a very grim podcast so far. You know, we focused a lot on the problems, and it would just be cool. You know, do you have an example of one of those stories where it's worked out really well?
Yeah. I mean, I think every story in the Indian women's team right now is a completely inspiring one. Each and every one of them are there because they've overcome so much to get there. And it's just so much we can learn from them. I'm sorry if this has seemed a really grim podcast, because I think there's just so much reason to be optimistic about the people that play cricket in India, especially the women that play cricket in India, because most of them are just completely awesome. You know, Indian women's cricket started because there were a bunch of 14-year-olds, 16-year-olds just deciding that they wanted to play cricket. And, you know, whatever happens, that they were just going to play cricket. And it's carried on for four decades after that now. Remarkably successfully, where a lot of other sports have fallen by the wayside. So you have people from that generation. You have the Shanta Rangaswamy. You have the Diana Adelji. You have, you know, Shubhangi Kulkarni. None of them are married. But I don't think that is the defining character of any of them. I mean, they're just all completely successful, inspiring women. And then you just have this new generation of girls that are completely taking that story forward. So I think, was it today or yesterday, it was Radha Yadav's birthday. She just turned 21. She's supporting her family, a family that started off, you know, as vegetable sellers, I think it was. You have Poonam Rao, who's supporting her parents. You have Shefali Verma, who, you know, as you said, at 16, is like hitting sixes everywhere. It's such an inspiring story. I mean, pretending to be a boy and playing is obviously something that a girl doesn't, you know, shouldn't have to do. But the fact that she did that and proved herself, I think, is worthy of celebration. Again, Smriti Mandana, Jemima Rodrigues, all of them have such amazing, inspiring stories. Shikha Pandey works for the Air Force, and she's such an articulate cricketer. I think, as I said, each and every one of them is massively inspiring. And including in the previous generation as well, we have Anjum Chopra, who's been the voice of cricket for so many generations now. And there are a lot of names that we don't really hear of as well, but they are involved in the domestic system. They are still identifying talent. They are still finding that Deepti Sharma and saying, you know, no, you need to go play cricket. There are so many of them trying to get jobs for these girls. It is a wonderful community to be part of. It's just that they could use more support.
I have to say, I do like this like positive note that we're kind of progressing onto and ending with. And I guess my next question, I just want to ask you, you know, who are your biggest cricketing heroes when you were growing up and getting into the sport?
I actually don't remember watching any women's cricket at all when I was young. I honestly probably watched very limited cricket, maybe just the World Cups and the occasional matches here and there. Or at least I don't remember any of it. I have a terrible memory for matches that I've watched. My interest, very honestly, began only once I started working in cricket and sort of realizing that there were stories beyond the ones that I usually saw. I have no memory of watching any women's cricket on TV at all. I think I had this vague notion that the 2013 World Cup was going on, and I read about it in the papers, but that was it. I don't remember watching anything at all, actually.
Wow.
So, my introduction to women's cricket was probably because I was just working on it. obviously, as you said, Mithali Raj is a name that you know whether you've watched cricket or not. I mean, even if you're just even somewhat interested in sport, you know of Mithali. I think by then, Anshum Chopra as well was a name that was taken in like media a little bit. But beyond that, I had no knowledge that women's cricket was the thing to the extent that it actually was.
I have to say, both me and anyone who's listening right now, I don't think any of us were expecting that answer. But I guess it's like that, right? Because I think you came through traditional sports journalism, you know, a traditional sports journalism path. And I guess with that path, you tend to cover a lot of sports, right?
So I came through a journalism path. And so I didn't start out in sports journalism, although I did want to major in it. So I wanted to do sports journalism because I like sport. And the sport that I watched on TV was obviously European sport or cricket. So, you know, lots of football, lots of tennis. Those were the things that you got to watch. You asked me what my first memory of tennis was. I can tell you, you know, those conversations happened in places where I grew around. I have never played cricket. I don't think I know how to hold a bat, quite honestly. I can talk about how one should, but I don't think I can actually do any of that. But again, I like to think that that actually helped me look at cricket and look at these players in a slightly different way.
So just to close things out, I think it's really important to address this. What can both fans as well as people in sports media and publishing, what can we do to support women's cricket and a push towards gender equality in cricket?
In the media, I think there's a fair bit of work to do. I'd say this work should probably happen in sort of two parts. First is hiring more women. I think sports, cricket journalism especially, is hugely dominated by the men. You have a podcast, it's probably going to be four men talking, and that does need to change. You can say, okay, there are not enough girls, not enough women joining, but then that's, again, personally, I believe that's up to the organizations to reach out, have these mentorship programs, have these internship programs. If it means you have to develop the talent, it's up to you to, you need to put in that work. And 5 years later, it means you're going to have more women in your team, but that's the work that needs doing. So that side of things is definitely, you know, just employing more women. Second is being aware of the language. You know, Cricket 4 recently did this thing where they said, we're going to call all batsmen batters. And that's great. And a lot of publications have been doing this. You'd speak to a lot of people that be like, you know, this is what we've always done. What's the big deal? I'm glad that Cricket 4 has made a big deal out of it, because you can see the absolute meltdown that has happened on their, you know, on their social feeds. And the fact that they've, you know, gone out and made such a big deal about it and saying, you know, this is the right thing to do. I think that is important as well. So that sort of visibility, being really aware of language, being aware of the number of stories you're publishing on men's cricket versus women's cricket. Maybe there needs to be a little bit of, you know, gender sensitivity training as well. The number of times I've sat in a press conference with Mithali Raj and, you know, had people ask her, you know, what will this do for women's cricket in India? That's a legitimate question, but that's also something that she's been talking about for 20 years. It just shows that there's not enough work that happens when you speak to a female sports person. And this is something that maybe I've done as well early on, and there's something I've been trying to actively not do. There needs to be a balance between looking at women's cricket as a vehicle for change and as just cricket. And I think all media organizations should sort of get that balance. It's not, you know, changing society shouldn't be on the shoulders of our female players only. Also look at them as batters, as bowlers with skill. So, you know, when we talk about Neetu David, we should be talking about how incredible she was as a bowler. What about her skill helped? So as of now, I think there is a tendency to sort of venerate a lot of these players and look at it as part of something bigger. And that's important. A lot of cricket journalism, a lot of sports journalism should look at things beyond just what happens in the field. But it's also important to treat a reporting with the rigor of reporting, you know. So essentially it means journalists do their work, do their research when you're commenting about a game or writing about a game. So that's what the media can do. What fans can do, well, starting off with don't be a troll. I think the amount of negative responses that things about women's cricket gets, like no one wants any change. As you know, there's so many people you see holding on to these really traditional ideas of what cricket should be. I think more and more we're seeing, especially if we want more women to come into the sport, either as, you know, as women working in sport or playing the sport, it means people need to be more flexible about things, especially fans. It's not like, oh, this is a gentleman's game and this is how it should always be. So understanding that cricket has a value in being more inclusive. And that's just something that comes with just educating yourself. So read more stories about women's cricket, about women's sport. Keep talking about it. If someone's talking about the, you know, women's IPL, amplify it. Be a part of these discussions. If there's a girl that comes to your ground and wants to play cricket, don't make her feel bad about it. If someone in your family wants to play cricket, find the resources and help them. At a very simple level, it's just about being more sensitive to the fact that women can take up a space and you know, just generally being okay with that.
Karunya, do you just want to wrap things up by plugging your social media channels? Where can people find you if they want more information and on Indian cricket and they just want more of Karunya?
I'm active on Twitter, so you can reach me at Cooks, that's KUKS. I'm also involved in a collaborative project, The Equal Hue, which we spoke about earlier with Snehal Pradhan, who's also an excellent, a former cricketer and an excellent commentator and an excellent person to follow when it comes to women's cricket, and the Sports Law and Policy Center in Bangalore. That is equalhue.in. That's equalhue.in. You can definitely sign up and we'll keep you posted about our projects and what we're trying to do to sort of rethink various things in women's cricket.
Thank you for listening. You can follow Karunya on Twitter at Cooks. That's KUKS. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at All Over Crick. You know, without the K-E-T. All Over Cricket is a multimedia publication featuring articles, podcasts, and videos from contributors spread across the world. We provide fans with original and engaging content that is reflective of the truly global and gender-inclusive sport that we believe cricket should be. If you like this podcast, please share it and tell your friends about All Over Cricket.